Live from New York City, it's the Gary Noll Show. And now, your host, Gary Noll.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Noll. I'd like to welcome you from all over the world, all the different syndicated stations, all the people listening live over the portable listening device, whether it's a cell phone or possibly in your radio, putting on speaker, or sitting at the internet or a land-based station. We have a lot to share today. We're going to talk about an Alpert Medical School, which is part of Brown University, mostly meat, high protein, linked with heart failure in women. This is with the hope that we can start to do something to save lives. The healthy benefits of flaxseed oil, we'll get into that in some depth, and why we should be using it on a daily basis, and how the omega-3 fatty acids, or a diet rich in it, can lower our blood pressure, from the University of Zurich, that's in Switzerland, and also how a Mediterranean-style diet can reduce heart failure, especially over the age of 40, University of Alabama, and vitamin D can reduce respiratory infections and help save some lives. And pessimism, yeah, that's common. That's associated with a risk of death from coronary heart disease. So we'll deal with that. That's from the Central Hospital in Finland, and a lot more on health. Today is our commentary day, and I'll be sharing about six different commentaries I've written, plus sharing some commentaries from people I respect, including Cornel West and Glenn Ford. I'll also be playing some audio clips from our audio file on issues that we do not hear about. For example, do you remember Jack Webb, who was a detective on television in the 1960s, he made a statement 50 years ago. And I'm going to play that statement and ask you to respond to it today in our talkback segment. Also, we're going to hear from Dr. Marcus Papadopoulos in a discussion on the BBC about Syria. Unlike the mainstream media or the faux democracy media on Pacific and other stations that say they support freedom but actually promote aggression in Syria and Libya and have the staff to have prevented this from happening, they have the resources. So if they have the resources and don't tell you the truth, then they have an agenda. I don't know what their agenda is, but at least know they have an agenda, because everything you've been told about Syria and why we're there and who's behind it is a lie. And we'll show you that today. Also, we will have Julian Assange sharing some input about something the American media is not covering. He fully cooperated with a Swedish investigating team, a seven-hour interview inside the Ecuadorian embassy in London concerning rape allegations. From the time these rape allegations came out in 2010, they stunk. Those of us who began to investigate and see was it true or what was behind it could not find it. Now, if Julian Assange is willing to take a lie detector test, but his accusers are not, even though a lie detector test is not permissible in a court of law, that still should say something. And, of course, we'll get to some other statements, including what some people who at that time were claiming they would do or have done. Hosts from MSNBC, hosts on Fox, that have him killed, and actually saying that have him killed. And these people were not fired or reprimanded. So now that Trump's in power, one of those people is going to be up in that administration. Good luck trying to be fair with Julian Assange and getting him a pardon, as some had hoped. Look, you can't even get a pardon for the people like Pelletier and others who deserve it, who are innocent. And imagine what's going to happen now. So we're going to play that tape so you hear them say this in their own words. Also today, I want to carry forward with something I began yesterday. I began to talk about, historically, we have had philosophers, and they have fallen into three categories. Those that were very bright, who were able to be just good people. I mean, you're going to find that they cared about the truth, even if it meant sacrificing their own life. They're rare. But we've had Spinoza's and Maimonides, Euridicles, Sophocles. But we've also had very bright people like Disraeli, who had both a dark side and a light side. He also was the most powerful, single, important voice in the longest running up to that point. Now, it's the Queen of England, Queen Elizabeth is the longest reigning monarch. But until that time, she was Queen Victoria. And he was the guiding principle. That's guiding it also during a time when Great Britain was colonizing more countries, putting more people into slavery, exploiting more people than ever before. And then you have those very smart people who only serve evil. And you think, why? If you're that much of a scholar, if you're that sensitive to the culture and arts, why would you go to the dark side? And I gave him examples. I'm going to give you a good example today, and I'm going to ask you a question. But when I ask you the question, I'm going to ask you to call in and see who in the audience gets it right. I won't say more than that. It'll be an interesting discussion. So we have a lot to share today. And I also am going to begin a three-part original investigative reporting series on sugar. Now, yes, I'll be mentioning some of the newest research showing sugar's bad in any amount, in any quantity, but also why no matter what is said against sugar, it will never be banned and people will not stop consuming it. I'll show you the politics of sugar in a special original series, which is online and posted. And I might mention posted with thousands upon thousands of other articles that are put up there every single day. And we're launching a brand new site tomorrow. So that's going to be very exciting. We've been working for 6 months on it. We want to be the one site in the world that has the most comprehensive articles from progressive minds on progressive themes on the planet. Currently, we post more articles than Al Jazeera, the BBC, and CNN combined every 24 hours. So it's not a surprise why tens of millions of people go to look for information and in the process, hopefully, listen to some shows. And also, the newest figures are coming out tomorrow of how many people are listening over the internet and downloading shows over the internet by telephone. Whoa, you won't believe it. I'll give you those figures tomorrow. But if you're not where you can listen by a land-based station or on a computer, but you can listen by a telephone or portable listening device, I've got two numbers. One, you listen live Monday to Friday, noon to 1 Eastern Standard Time. And by the way, starting Friday, half my show will be devoted to talkback, meaning anything that you find important that you want to share your insights and opinions on, you'll have an opportunity to do so. The first half of the program, I'll bring on Remarkable Minds. So it's going to be a wonderful show. Remarkable Minds, first 30 minutes. Talkback, the second 30 minutes. That begins tomorrow. I'm not going to do it anymore on Tuesday night because I simply didn't have enough time for me to do the work I consider important for me, so I'm moving it over to Friday. Here's the number you call in to listen live. Write it down, please. 701-801-3662. 701-801-3662. Now, if you can't listen live and you want to download it sometime later in the day or at night, go to the archives. Here's the archive. Listen over the phone number. 701-719-9976. 701-719-9976. So let's begin because we have a lot to share. I was actually listening while I was writing some commentaries this morning to a person being interviewed at one of the international conferences on the environment, and which I believe they're doing completely wrong, and I'll share that on an upcoming show, what I believe we should be doing to change our position. And one person was suggesting they're allocating or trying to allocate $100 billion a year. That won't do anything. That'll do zip. And someone says, no, we need $1 trillion. And right there, we should have had one of those moments where we freeze frame everybody. We freeze frame the person screaming, we need $1 trillion. And you see, are you eating hamburgers? Yeah, so what? We realize that methane, which is 2200% more lethal than CO2 in creating global warming, you could reduce that if you stopped eating anything with a heartbeat or a face. That means instead of demanding the world cough up $1 trillion where we don't know where it would be spent, by you stopping eating meat and going to a plant-based diet, you're stopping a lot of that carbon footprint. Secondly, when you buy something that's locally grown and organic, that's a lot better than buying it coming in 5,000 miles if you live in Florida and you're buying it from, let's say, Washington State or California. So that's another way, going out to go to local farmers markets or food co-ops. Thirdly, if you're going to be that conscious of buying things locally that are organic, then you can also become a part of the no-spray coalitions. Now, you might think, well, what will that do? Well, you have to go back 22 years to where there were hearings in New York City. I attended as a scientist. Mitchell Cohen attended as an educated consumer activist who had helped collect information and led many of the protests in local parks against the city spraying. And there are about 9 other people who were against it. Well, in time, we were able, a tiny minority of empowered, educated people with good facts and good scholarship, to put a moratorium on it. Now, there comes a time when you win, you lose, you win something, but at least you're progressing the idea. So if you're going to be organic, non-GMO, then you're going to want no more glyphosate sprayed on any of the foods or the foods eaten by your family. Then you're going to be aware that, gee whiz, you mean I can live a longer life, have less heart disease, cancer, if I'm eating plant-based healthy foods with fibers and polyphenols? Yes. But if I'm eating a typical American diet, I'm speeding up the death process, I'm putting myself exposure of disease, which I may or may not be able to pay for, even with co-pays? Yes. So it's just all good. But it takes time. We must be patient. But that's what happens when I'm hearing someone scream that, oh, we can do this, without realizing, do something from a higher level of consciousness, even if at the time very few or no one else seems to care about it. A year after my film on Seeds of Death aired and a series of specials I did on KPFK in Los Angeles, where I was for 31 years, 6 hours every week, suddenly a woman starts an effort to address their concerns. This is not a scientist, not a social activist, a concerned citizen. And that woman became the person who single-handedly started a movement to which millions, tens of millions, have now joined. It's called March Against Monsanto. So never assume that because you're one person against the majority that you can't make a difference. Oh, yes, you can. In fact, almost every major movement started with one person with a good idea, and then over time collected other ideas and other people and shared a responsibility to move that message forward. But the quality of your message, how it is presented, and sustaining messages. For example, right now, tomorrow I'm going to be filming in a small island off the coast of Seattle, one of the world's leading environmental scientists, the next day in Alaska. Later today, we're filming in another undisclosed location. I've got a lot of filming to do. Now, normally, I wouldn't be doing this at this time, but because Donald Trump is against the environmental degradations and against anything that's renewable, organic, or natural, and since he is looking to put someone in a position to oversee our science programs and our environment programs who are in denial of science and denial of the environment, I believe that we have an opportunity. Again, instead of yelling and screaming, why not do something that is constructive? A series of articles by the world's leading environmentalists put into lay language talking about here's what's going to be happening now, here's what has happened that is directly related to environmental degradation, and here's what we can do about it that can help lessen it individually, collectively, and societally, even if we don't have that power at this moment politically. You see, after these elections, everybody goes to sleep. That's exactly when we should awaken. It's our time, meaning those people who are not aligned with either of the of the solidified, codified, completely corrupt Democrat-Republican machines, the establishment. It is now time for those 100 million independent who didn't vote, time for the one man, Jill Stein, highly educated, highly motivated, highly insightfuls who did, and time for the 4 to 5 million Gary Johnson, libertarians, to realize you're on the right side of history with 22 of your ideas, very progressive. You're on the wrong side of common sense, reason, history on 12 of your ideas. Let us come together and let us both make our arguments and see if in any way you can see the rightness in challenging your own deficiency, because of the philosophy I have that you can never grow further than your weakest link. I don't care what it is in life. Whatever you're not willing to acknowledge, you can't change. What you're not willing to change is as far as you're ever going to be able to grow. You can stay in the same place, but you're not going to grow. So now imagine that starting in just probably mid-January, every single week for the next 52 weeks, we will be writing and sharing over the internet the most in-depth, comprehensive, lay-based articles, fully documented, on why we can do things about the environment. Things we're not even talking about, like acid rain in all the lakes in America, the destruction of all the northern timber in the United States by beetles because of global warming, the acidification of the Mississippi and Missouri rivers, the dead zones throughout those areas, the degradation of our soil from nitrogen fertilizers, the type of non-sustainable aquifers in at least 20 states, including California, Texas, at least for all except one small part of Texas, the Northeast Texas, and Oklahoma, Nevada. They're not sustainable. There is no future there. And we're not talking about in someone else's lifetime. We're talking about the next 5 years. So that, along with the most hard-hitting documentary ever produced in American history on the environment. And that's coming at you as quickly as I can finish the last part of it. I've been filming it 7 years. It's just I'm squeezing it all in because now's our opportunity to change minds, influence people with common sense, reason, facts. And every week we'll get more, and every week more, and every week more. And when you think there's no more, we'll give you more. And when you think you know it all, we'll show you what you don't know. So that's what we're doing. That's just my office. So now we have coming up in 2 months a conference call with 2,000 of the world's greatest minds. You won't hear me say this again. No one will talk about it. But 2,000 people who are known for having great insightful ideas, who are all progressives, who are not a part of the political machinery, are going to share how we can create new initiatives at the local level based upon the being in touch with what people need instead of tone deaf to what everyone else has been. And I'll let you know when that has been completed and all the different responsibilities assigned, and that's when the rest of the public will be able to participate based upon what interests them, where they live, what their resources are, to the degree they want to commit to some time and energy on single issues. We're going to have 50 issues, but you take the issue you want and all the information you need. You need documentaries, you need articles, you need speakers, you need legislation written, you need local legislation written, you need candidates to run locally. We'll have it all. So for those of you who are out in the streets angry, crying, sorry that Trump got elected, to the contrary, would you be out there complaining and angry if the Clintons were elected? What would be the difference in your mindset today? Imagine this. Would you be empathetic with the women in Iraq who lost 500,000 of their children? Would you be concerned about how the Clintons knew and supported Kagame and the Rwanda genocide, and it's been covered up and we have evidence of that? Would you change your point of view if you were shown a truth? Or are you so committed, like a cultist, that no matter what truth, you're going to be drinking the Kool-Aid and angry at anyone who tries to take it out of your hand or explain there's a consequence to your actions? I see this as a moment of liberation and hence celebration. I believe that this is an opportunity we rarely get, because for years, every single thing that we within the progressive movement tried to share and did, all the articles we had sent to the people on every conservative and liberal radio program, television program from Keith Olbermann, never returned any of this information. No one did. Not a single person out of hundreds that we would send all this to on a regular basis. So now we don't have to rely upon them anymore. While they weren't paying attention, a progressive movement has grown together. They would be dumbfounded if they knew how many people there are. They just wouldn't believe it. So when it comes to meat, and if you're out there screaming against the environment, are you also looking in the mirror while you're eating that piece of meat? In which case, you got a case of cognitive dissonance, in which case, if you don't see the irony in what you say and what you do, then you're part of the problem, not the solution. From Albert Medical School, Brown University, women over the age of 50 who follow a high-protein diet could be at higher risk of heart failure, especially if their protein comes from meat. And this was presented to the American Heart Association Scientific Sessions. They looked at 103,000 women over a five-year period, and they found that those who had the most amount of meat had the highest amount of heart disease and died the fastest. So there's one more reason to choose a healthy plant-based diet. Now, there's also good reason to use flaxseed oil. Yes, you can eat flaxseed, but it's not my first suggestion. If you're a cow, if you're a horse, if you're a sheep, you're a lamb, yes, because of the chambers in your stomach that will break down this rough lignocellulose into its simple sugars and liberate its oils, you won't have that advantage. You're going to pass this right through. So if you already have it pressed, cold pressed, then you have the oils, which are those wonderful plant omega-3 fatty acids, plus the dietary fiber, and it makes a big difference. Why? Because flaxseed oil is not the same as other oils. And it's very rich in oil. It's 40% oil by weight, according to the Jefferson Agricultural Institute. And flax is really good because it goes immediately into your system. That's terrific because you get a high bioavailability. And it's also got the good DHA fats. And in fact, there was a study at Harvard University entitled The Preventable Causes of Death in the United States, Comparative Risk Assessment of Dietary Lifestyle Metabolic Risk Factors. They looked at all these deaths and found out flaxseed oil makes a big difference. So here's what you got to know. If you take a teaspoon of flaxseed oil each day, you help, along with healthy diet and exercise, to reduce the risk of cancer, aid the growth of your hair and fingernails, to promote healthier skin, to reduce menopausal symptoms, to help burn body fat. And also from the University of Zurich in Switzerland, if you're taking in the omega fatty acids, according to multiple studies, they looked at 70 different randomized controlled trials, and they looked at the omega-3 fatty acids. The results, these were all double-blind, and it showed that you can lower your blood pressure. This is published in the American Journal of Hypertension, Volume 27, Number 7. So when you consider how many hundreds of thousands of people die every year from stroke, two of my friends died just 1 8 weeks ago and another one a year and a half ago, it was some stroke. And they were not eating their omega-3 fatty acids, I can tell you. So let's prevent that from happening. And for Americans, you're not consuming enough potassium. Coconut water, that gives you about 400 milligrams. That's good. You need about 500 milligrams a day, but you're eating way too much salt, about 3,600 milligrams average per day. And we don't need that. No, we need, from all sources of potassium, we need about 2,200 milligrams. But women tend to have lower potassium levels, and that puts you at risk of a heart attack and a stroke. So make sure you're getting enough potassium. Go easy on the sodium and higher on the potassium. I'm Gary Noll. That's the latest on health and nutrition. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. I'd like to welcome all of you. If you're just coming across this channel, I'm Gary Nall. As often as it's possible, I write, research, and then share with you original, in-depth investigative reporting articles, fully documented. They're all based upon quality scholarship, and I post them, in case you don't have a chance to listen live, to our website. You can go to the website, download these articles. There is a public service, as all of them are, for free. The new one, that will be in three parts. Part one today, the deadly at any dose, sugar and the corruption of science. Now, it's estimated that the average American consumes 94 grams of sugar every day. This amounts to nearly 2 billion pounds of sugar each month in the form of candies, cakes, breads, cookies, and other sweets for the average American, meaning collectively. Our national sugar addiction rages on despite the fact that sugar is widely known as a major culprit in our country's epidemic level of disease. A recent report from Credit Suisse Research Institute revealed that approximately 30 to 40% of healthcare expenditures in the United States go to help address issues that are closely tied to the excess consumption of sugar. The figures suggest that our high consumption of sugar runs at an incredible $1 trillion, that's with a T, trillion dollars in healthcare costs every year. So my question is, when was last time our Surgeon General, President of the United States, the U.S. Public Health Service Director, the head of the FDA, any of the governmental agencies, came out with a press conference saying, this is the second largest expense in our entire medical budget. Our number one expense is administrative expenses. That's about $1.2 trillion. But sugar is leading to diseases that are costing us $1 trillion. Shouldn't we prevent the diseases on a humanitarian basis just to help people not suffer? But also, aren't we better off when people can be healthy than when they're sick? Well, it depends upon which side of the equation you're on. If you're there to profit off people's sickness, you don't want people to know they can prevent the sickness you're profiting from. The Credit Suisse report highlighted several health conditions, including coronary heart disease, type 2 diabetes, and metabolic syndrome, which numerous studies have linked to excessive sugar intake. Though it takes little effort to discover the abundance of scientific research demonstrating sugar's deadly effects on health, most Americans simply to prefer to ignore what I call intentional neglect, intentional ignorance. It's not that people are stupid. What may in the long term look like a stupid action because they could have known, should have known, and still did it anyhow, does not address why people do things against their own best interest. Why do people do things that self-sabotage? The reality is that sugar is a staple in people's diets. But let's take a closer look at a few of the latest studies available to them if you choose to look. Now, I only use mainstream peer-reviewed literature because when I go before a government committee, I'm under oath, I have to present my information. I'm fully aware that sitting beside or behind that legislator, more often than not, are representatives of the very industry that I'm going to challenge. They're going to try to find any mistake, any error. And thus far, nothing, zip, zero. So then they simply stay quiet, figuring, okay, we had our hearings, everything will go back to normal. And more often than not, it does. So it's not that we don't have science on our side. We have all of science on our side. Let me give you examples. The prestigious scientific journal Human Reproduction published a study showing that girls who consume higher amounts of sugar, sweetened beverages, began menstruating earlier than their peers. That's negative. Earlier menstruation among girls, by the way, just so you understand, that increases your risk of breast cancer later in life. The study is notable because other dietary sugar drink consumption can also show you that the same increase in body mass index, and it correlates to earlier menstruation. The link between sugar and breast cancer and lung cancer was the focus of another study published this year by researchers at the University of Texas. The team showed that high fructose consumption among rats promoted lung and breast metastasis. The researchers fed the rats dietary amounts of fructose consistent just with the standard American diet, which is a completely pro-inflammatory diet because sugar is always pro-inflammatory. Another study done in the last 6 months, carried out by scientists at Queensland University of Technology in Brisbane, Australia, showed sugar may be just as addictive as hard drugs, as heroin and as cocaine, as it affects the dopamine levels in the brain just as severely as other substances like cocaine does. Now, these conclusions are backed by more than multiple studies, including another study from a year before published in the journal PLOS One, demonstrating that sugar-laden and highly refined foods are among the main culprits for food addiction. Then you have to look at all the studies. If you want citations, I list them in the articles. Corn syrup linked with obesity, and every one of these is a different study. I won't go through the journals like this was the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, Volume 9, number 79, number 4, page 537. I won't give you that. It's all there. You can find that for yourself. I'll just give you the titles. Fructose intake connected with increased risk of cardiovascular illness and diabetes in teenagers. Fructose consumption increased the risk of heart disease. A negative impact of sugar drinks on children. Sugar and high blood pressure. And sugar consumption associated with fatty liver disease and diabetes. So we have all those studies. So the documents show that a trade group, the Sugar Research Foundation, known today as the Sugar Association, paid three Harvard scientists, the equivalent of about $50,000 in today's dollars, to publish a 1967 review of research on sugar and fat and heart disease. And I'm quoting now, this is from the New York Times, the study used in the reviews were handpicked by the sugar group, and the article, which was published in the prestigious New England Journal of Medicine, minimize the link between sugar and heart health and cast aspersions on the role of saturated fat, end quote. It was this seminal research that has influenced government health guidelines for 50 years. Quote, so profound are the conflicts of interest in science today that a 2015 article appearing in the American Heart Association Circulation Research found that, quote, the majority, I repeat, the majority of research published today, quote, will not stand the test of time. That same year saw the publication of another article in The Lancet, which author Richard Horton summarized that much of the scientific literature, perhaps half, 50%, may simply be untrue. Half. Now, you got to look at all the afflicted by studies with small sample sizes, tiny effects, invalid exploratory analysis, and flagrant conflicts of interest. And so that means that those who control the science control the outcome. So here's the point I'm going to make. Why do we stand on the side of bad science? Well, I could say the same about why do we stand on the side of bad economics? Why do we stand on the side of bad education? Why do we stand on the side of bad social justice issues, like creating a prison system that further indentures people and exploits them once they're already in prison, or puts people in prison because they can't pay a debt? That shouldn't be ever punishable by a crime. Someone can't pay a bill because they're so poor, so now you put them in a debtor's prisons to exploit them even further. But our whole system is standing on the side of what is bad all the time. And it's from all groups. Just think about it this, if you're an evangelical. And I know we have a lot of evangelicals listening. And I'm not criticizing your religion, but I sure as hell am criticizing your preachers. If they're those preachers who stand in their gold-lined pulpit and tell you they need $70 million to buy a private jet so they can, when they're praying, they're higher and closer to God. Now, if you can buy that, whoa, then think of all the other lies you'll buy based upon being convinced upon the personality of the person in power rather than whether it's reasonable or makes common sense. And charismatic leaders are always in line to manipulate you. So just imagine those in the world of science who come out with absolute certainty, but they're always wrong. So with the rapid spread of information in today's internet age, more and more health conscious consumers and watchdog groups are calling attention to the many studies demonstrating sugar's harmful effects. But many of us in the natural health movement have been alarming the public for decades. In point of fact, I've been writing about the hazards of sugar extensively in books and articles since 1971. In 2002, my documentary Seven Steps to Perfect Health premiered on PBS stations, including WIDA in Washington, D.C., as part of PBS program. I poured sugar out of a bag on the air, live, which equaled the exact amount of teaspoons that the average American teenager consumes in a given day. The quantity was verified by my general counsel, David Slater, who had measured the number of teaspoons earlier in the day on a gram scale. If anything, my demonstration understated the true amount of sugar we are consuming. The program was very well received, and the program director informed me that it was so successful that it had set a record for a non-primetime programming and that he intended on replaying it 8 to 9 times in the rest of that drive. However, the next day I was informed by him that he was sorry, but he had bad news. Not only would the program not be aired, but I would never again be allowed on PBS in Washington, D.C. I said, "What did I do wrong?" He said, "You didn't do anything wrong. You did everything right." He said, "But it's higher up than me." This was after I had presented 5 medically vetted original PBS programs over the years, some of which had set, in fact, all of them had set station records, but my first one set all the records in the history of PBS before or after for an individual. Now, the program director explained that this was all because of the new information I presented on the dangers of sugar had run smack up against the president of the station's board, Sharon Rockefeller. I was told that Ms. Rockefeller had received a phone call from the sugar lobbying group representing soft drink makers and sugar consumers, and the decision was made to pull my program. I was informed that special interests, including what was I told? I was told this, that Al Franken received $27,999. Quote, "Sugar is the only industry in the entire agribusiness sector that has consistently supported Democrats during the past 2 decades. Then why did you accept money from the sugar industry? The fact that these authorities who took it upon an official are often compromised by lobbyists inside the Beltway, while the mainstream media, enthralled to its advertisers, is still unwilling to report the whole truth about sugar." And I might mention that what I did is we wrote a blistering response. We wrote a response that showed all the scientific documents, what they were doing was wrong. We showed Sharon Rockefeller was on the board of Pepsi-Cola. We sent this to every member of the PBS board. We sent it to every member of the Sugar Institute. And then I invited Sharon Rockefeller. I invited the head of the sugar board. I invited any number of scientists they wanted to bring on, just me against the entire sugar industry, because the truth on the side of one is still a majority in my world. So I don't care how many bought and paid for scientists you bring on your side. If we believe we have the truth, we will stand against you. And that's what we did. But we found no matter where we went, there were legislators who had accepted money from the sugar interest. And we found out that whoever puts up the big money for PBS programs, you dictate programming. We shouldn't have it that way, but that's true on NPR, and it's sure as hell true on PBS. So we sent them a letter. We challenged them. And that was not my first time dealing with the politics of sugar. So then you have to look. You're dealing with a local public television station that probably does do some outstanding programming and has some good people affiliated, but all it takes is one head of a board, Sharon Rockefeller, to stop other programs that should be on the air from having a chance to share their information. And all it takes is one very powerful organization that is should be held accountable for crimes against humanity, because when we can show $1 trillion a year in medical expenses and heart disease and cancer, and we have a preponderance of scientific evidence on our side, you have none on your side, unless, of course, you somehow, looking back to 1967, you're able to manipulate science through manipulating your editors, then try that today. Because once we find out that you're doing it, we're going to be there to challenge you. You want to hold a hearing? Bring us on. Put us under oath. And let's see what the response is. So right now, people are consuming more sugar than ever before. They will not stop because what it makes them feel like and how much we use it as a comfort food. They should stop, but they won't. The government's not going to warn them. Only concerned citizens who have seen the impact of sugar, only concerned local and some national health groups will put the word out. But you're also up against an enormous political machine that they have bought. You're up against the media that is not on your side, but theirs. That does not mean we should give up. It means that we should do all the more. And just like this article, share it. Send it out to everyone you know. If people don't know the truth, then how can they possibly change? We need the truth on our side. Part one, part two, and the next day or two. We're going to take a brief break, and we're going to come back with more insights. Please stay with us. A question for you. There were two very prominent people in British history. One I consider the most evil person in the history of British history, and yet that person is the most popular person as of any, including the Queen. And the other one is probably totally forgotten. Do you know who would get my vote for the most important person in Great Britain's history, and who would get my vote for the worst person in Great Britain's history? Our talkback line is 888-874-4888, 888-874-4888. Now, for those of you who are looking at all these neo-fascist, lobbyist, corporatists who are lining up to take positions, and you know how much bad is going to come from that, here's why we should be at a time of actually optimism. Because now the people unifying, who are our modern-day philosophers, our wise men and women, now's a time for us to call upon them. Cornel West, clearly within America's prolific tradition of great men and women who fought for economic and social and racial justice. Chris Hedges, also in the American prophetic tradition and socialism, to call out falsehoods for what they are. And Rabbi Michael Lerner, the torchbearer of geopolitical peace and the most vocal antidote against the Jewish lobby and its uncritical support of the Likud regime in Israel. Michelle Alexander, African-American law professor at Ohio State University, who's become the unconscious voice of the African-American community, because if she were the conscious voice, A, you would have never voted for Barack Obama, and B, he would have been absolutely at 0% popularity because of what he's done to sell out his soul. Jill Stein and Ralph Nader, two of the most important political activists who see the big picture, are tireless and are selfless. Then we also have Martha Nussbaum, University of Chicago, and Judith Butler, leading feminist philosophers in gender, feminist, and LGBT politics and culture, and understanding the underpinnings of sexual regression within the conservative mindset that contributes to misogyny and the sexual submission of women. You have Bart Ehrman, one of our most important New Testament scholars, University of North Carolina, and he's capable of deconstructing the untruths in the right-wing evangelical churches that have fueled the Trump revolt. Bill McKibben, Naomi Klein, both important within the environmental movement. Frances Moore LePay, a woman I have an enormous amount of respect for, who's been there a long time. In fact, she and I both were at Ballantine Books together when she was doing her Dive for a Small Planet. She has never wavered, and she has been consistent in all these years. Andrew Harvey, a mystic philosopher, articulating the global ethical basis of spiritual activism. Because if we're going to win, our activism must be spiritual. Determinist, yes. And that has not been done for a long time. Jim Garrison, a pioneer in a revolution in global higher education to educate future generations. And so we have these. But then just look back to the 20th century. We have the late Sheldon Wolin, professor emeritus of political science at Princeton, and earlier at Berkeley, the father of free speech movement, who accurately articulated the new kind of totalitarianism, what he called inverted totalitarianism. And Albert Einstein, by the way, not just the founder of relativity and the harbinger of quantum physics, but a deep social critic and agnostic spiritual philosopher who clearly saw the dangers within the American democracy by powerful forces. Martin Luther King and Howard Thurman, that goes without saying. Also, Rabbi Abraham Heschel, he was like a Jewish Martin Luther King. Thomas Kuhn, MIT historian of science, who first mapped with great clarity how revolutions in scientific paradigms take place. And Aldous Huxley, novelist, mystic, great mind, a naturalist philosopher, a different kind of social prophet who identified the hidden powers in the cultural psyche and politics that bring humanity closer to its own self-destruction. Dorothy Day, founder of the Catholic Women's Movement, whose philosophy of our relationship with the poor is as relevant today as it was 70 years ago. Similarly, also Carl Jung, founder of the analytic psychology and father of transpersonal psychology, he best articulated the fascist mindset and its relations to the collective unconscious of the masses, how people can become a part of a massive fascist movement. We're seeing that today on both sides. Remember, both the left, corporate left, and the corporate right are both engaged in fascism, the acceptance and actual embrace of totalitarianism. Bertrand Russell, the nationalist philosopher of science, who first articulated the threats of what it means to have fascism within science. And Eugene Debs, America's greatest 20th century socialist, and he was an inspirer, Bernie. And then you have some people in Great Britain. Let's just see if we have anyone on the line who knows who I am talking about. We have, who do we have up here? No calls yet? No calls? Okay. Well, then let me tell you who I consider the most important voice in the history of the British Empire. My best person would be William Wilberforce. W-I-L-B-E-R-F-O-R-C-E. You should know about this man. He was a member of Parliament. He started the anti-slavery campaign, including within the British colonies in the mid-1980s. In 1907, he won the passage of the Slave Trade Act against the British slave trade. He was responsible for the Slavery Abolition Act of 1833. By the way, he died just 3 days before it was passed. He also founded the first animal welfare organization, the Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals. That was William Wilberforce. And so he also did some things that were stupid, but that does not preclude him from being my number one person if I was showing a brilliant person who did good, because then I got to show you a brilliant person who did bad. And the person who is at the top of my bad list would be Winston Churchill. And yet today he would be considered the hero, the most popular person in probably British history. He was prime minister from 1940 to 45 and again from 50 to 55. He got the Nobel Prize in Literature in 53. He was a prolific writer. He was made an honorary U.S. citizen in 1963. He was a rampant racist. He was a white supremacist. He denied the wrongs Europeans did to Native Americans and blacks in Australia. He believed in the value of eugenics and racial hierarchy, as did the Nazis. But for Churchill, the Protestant Christians were at the top of the food chain as far as their purity. He advocated for the use of chemical weapons against the Kurds and Afghans in 1919 because they were considered, in his own writings, quote, uncivilized tribes. His lack of action dealing with the famous Bengal famine in 1953 killed over 3 million, that's 3 million people, He had rice there, but he wanted it all exported and none to feed the people of Bengal, which he could easily have done. So 3 million dead Bengals are in his head. He had horrible statements about Gandhi. He called him a bad man. And Churchill was always on the far right wing about Indian politics. His attitudes towards Jews supported the Zionist cause for a Jewish state, but also saw it as a way for the United Kingdom to get rid of its own Jewish citizens. He had harsh comments about them, and that's ended up having what was called the Tony Pandy riots between the miners and the owners, which led to violence. He was very anti-Irish. He supported the blacks and the tans in Ireland and wanted to conduct air bombings on Ireland. So you have some good people who principally did good, Wilberforce. There were some things he did that I would absolutely oppose. But he also was light years ahead of William Churchill. I'm Gary Nall. Now we're going to play something I thought you would find of interest. Now, instead of playing it, I'm going to instead share a commentary. And this commentary is from Glenn Ford. Glenn Ford is one of the most important progressive minds in America today. This is called From Black Agenda Report. None of them have ever been my president. As a revolutionary black nationalist whose socialism predates my facial hairs, I have no problem saying Donald Trump is not my president. Neither is the current occupant of the White House, Barack Obama. Nor were any of the Democrats, Republicans, or others that preceded him. On a chilly November day in 2009, a newly created coalition of which I was co-founder marched on the White House to denounce and renounce Barack Obama as a tool of white supremacy and the imperial war machine. Obama, Obama, you can't hide. We charge you with genocide. We shouted, indicating the first black president for the crimes he was busily committing in service to his masters on Wall Street. The Black is Black Coalition for Social Justice, Peace, and Reparations had been formed less than 2 months before, largely to demonstrate that not all black people were bamboozled by the slick corporate politician from Chicago, elected 1 year earlier in the nation's first billion-dollar presidential campaign. As our coalition press release stated, black and brown people continue to suffer the brunt of unemployment, underemployment, and predatory loan scandal crisis. Military spending under Obama has increased, as have the warfare this nation continues to export to Iraq, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Venezuela, and Colombia. Mass incarceration, brutal police brutality, and political imprisonment remains rampant, end quote. The Black is Black Coalition warned of the, quote, traps set by Obama's so-called post-racial politics that perpetuates the same oppressive militaristic agenda well known during the Bush regime. To paraphrase Fidel Castro, history was vindicated. Obama joined George Bush and Bill Clinton in perpetuating the 20-year-long slaughter in the Democratic Republic of Congo that has claimed more than 6 million lives. Obama mobilized NATO air forces and jihadist proxies to destroy Libya, which had previously enjoyed the highest living standards in Africa. He redeployed these same al-Qaeda terrorists to Syria, killing 400,000 people, displacing half the surviving population, and bringing the U.S. to the very brink of nuclear war with Russia. This so-called son of Africa has effectively occupied most of the continent through a U.S. military command, AFRICOM, that was less than a year old when Obama was sworn into office. The African Union provides diplomatic cover for the CIA-run peacekeeping mission in Somalia, while U.S. conventional forces have infiltrated the militaries of all but two African nations. The holdouts, well, Zimbabwe, are under constant threat of regime change, and Obama joined George Bush and Bill Clinton in continuing a business as usual. With the eager assistance of Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, Obama badly abetted a Nazi spearheaded coup against the elected government in Ukraine and then blamed Moscow when Russia-speaking Ukrainians resisted, provoking a new Cold War that could turn hot in an instant. At the same time, Obama pivoted to militarily confront China, whose economy is already, by some measure, larger than the United States. The jihadist war in Syria should also be seen as a theater of imperialism's last-ditch offensive to encircle Eurasia in hopes of preserving U.S.-based multinational corporate dominance of a rigged system of dollar-based world trade. Just as the Black is Black coalition warned, Barack Obama was the black face of imperialism, a change of color without a difference. He tried to hand off the controls to Hillary Clinton, who got 6 million votes less than he did and lost. Back in 2007, Obama and Clinton were pretending to be ideological opponents. As cookie-cutter corporate Democrats often do, we at Black Agenda Report wrote that, quote, there's not a dime's worth of difference between the two. Every decent, peace-loving person on earth should be glad to be rid of both of them. Humanity would probably not survive another year of either one. Donald Trump is also a danger to humanity. Like every other U.S. chief executive since Truman nuked Hiroshima and Nagasaki, if words mean anything, Trump starts off posing less of a doomsday international menace, since he claims he wants to establish talking rather than shouting, threatening, nuke-rattling relations with Russia and China, while Clinton's version of reset was an armed confrontation with Russia over the skies of Syria. Of course, all that could quickly change. Trump may be a party of one among Republicans in Congress and even in his own cabinet. And that's from Glenn Ford. I'm Gary Nall. I want to thank you all for taking the time to listen in today, and we look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Have a nice day, everyone.
Hey, you! Come out here on the floor. Let's rock some more. Come out of here on the floor. Honey, let's rock some more, yeah. Now when you get out here, don't you have no fear. Put your hands on your hip and let your backbone slip and work out. Ah, my mama, move up. Honey, move back. Shuffle to the left. Wobble to the right. Now it's plain to see you.